I warned you it was going to happen. We're now out of free space, and you know what? Yes, we are paying so that we can keep all our old episodes online. And we're perfectly happy to do this, and we're perfectly happy to keep giving you this fine podcast completely free of charge. I mean, really, it's like three podcasts for the price of one. But you know what? I would much rather spend the money on improving the podcast, helping us get to more people out there, and in particular, getting ourselves some better equipment so you can get crystal clear, crisp interviews when we go out and about. So how can you help us do this? Well, first up, you can head to our Podomatic page, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and on there you'll find a donate button. Feel free to send a few dollars our way if you have a little bit spare. Be much appreciated. And we are hoping to also reward those donators who are a bit more generous. Alternatively, if you have a product or service you think may be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please get in touch with us at rufusreviews.gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Now on with the podcast. Hello and welcome to The Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to geek news, movies, local events, and pretty much whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and I'll be joined a little bit later on by our good friend, Christian Fletcher. And let me tell you, we've got a great podcast in store for you this time around. After the geek news, we'll have a look at the PlayStation release of the indie classic Rogue Legacy. With this podcast timing being pretty much the eve of the annual Brisbane Madonna Party, Christian's going to have a look at some of Madonna's theatrical highlights and perhaps a few lowlights. I finally got to see Marvel blockbuster Guardians of the Galaxy, so we've got a review of that for you as well. Before moving on to our redeeming features, which features, I guess, one of the most famous bad movies of all time. Now, we do have a few interviews for our local wildlife section in the pipeline, but unfortunately nobody came through in time for this particular episode. Okay, so, but believe me, we've got some great ones coming up. Christian will let us know some of the other events coming up soon, and, as always, we've got some prizes to give away to you. So sit back and enjoy the podcast. Well, topping this podcast geek news is the final screening of Guardians of the Galaxy. Yes, the movie that Marvel's been making us salivate over for well over a year has finally been released and has made a few headlines of its own. First, of course, it had a phenomenal opening weekend, blitzing the box office and creating rave reviews. And of course, you're going to be able to hear mine just a little bit later on. But that's not the only reason it made headlines. A couple of theatres out there actually had a few boxes labelled Guardians that they put on thinking it was the great new Guardians of the Galaxy movie. This made the various patrons quite surprised when instead of seeing the adventures of Star-Lord and co, they instead saw the not-too-shabby kids movie Rise of the Guardians being played instead. You can understand this maybe being a one-off, but this happened quite a few times in a number of different cinemas. I think they need to be a bit clearer with their labelling. Another interesting byproduct is that the fantastic soundtrack actually made it to number one in the USA and number two in the UK quite quickly after the release of the film. It's pretty impressive for an album that's full of 70s classics. Well done, Marvel. Well done. I even have some podcast-related news that links in as well. Surprise, surprise. First up, after you see Guardians of the Galaxy, if you're a little confused about something that happens in that final post-credits scene, well, I suggest you go back and have a listen to the Who You're Gonna Call episode of this very podcast. It might clear up a couple of things for you. Okay, but afterwards, I cannot stress this enough. See the movie, then revisit that podcast, okay? We got a deal? Good, good. I'm going to trust you guys, okay? I'm going to trust you guys. Secondly, the Rufus Project has launched its own streaming channel. Now that we have access to a PS4, I've set up a Ustream channel under the Rufus Project banner. The only thing there is my first attempt at streaming, which was the Guardians of the Galaxy Zen pinball table. I've still got to work a bit with the levels, because you can't really hear what I'm saying over the sound effects of the pinball, but hey, you know, it's a good start, and it's a pretty fun pinball. Anyway, enough of that fun stuff. Let's look at what else has been going on. Oh god, this is pitiful. So, in Australia, on top of all the anti-piracy stuff that's been going on, guess what? The Prime Minister has announced that yes, we're going to have mandatory data retention of metadata. Oh boy. So essentially, Australians listening out there, the government thinks you're guilty until proven otherwise. Okay. Yes, there's going to need to be warrants to access it. But it still means that the internet providers have to build great big server farms in order to contain all the metadata for the required 2 years. Gee, I wonder where the extra cost of running those is going to get passed to. In other great Aussie politician news, the Minister for Communication, Malcolm Turnbull, went on ABC one night saying that yes, there is an issue with content availability in Australia, especially on the digital spectrum. And that, yes, the entertainment companies should be trying harder to get content to Australians. Thank you very much, Malcolm. That was very sensible. Well, it was for 24 hours, until he appeared on Sky News, and then basically said that the entertainment companies need to pull their fingers out, grow a pair, and sue the consumer if they want to fight downloading of content. Yep, yep. Thanks, Malcolm. You're almost on our side there. Surprisingly, in response to this, our good friend Graham Burke has come out and made a sensible statement for once. He said, as the head of Village Roadshow, that they are not going to be looking at taking legal action against consumers because all that does is make the lawyers rich. Graham Burke, CEO of Village Roadshow, has made a sensible statement about copyright and piracy. I'm kind of scared. Oh, speaking of Sky TV, their New Zealand counterpart, well, they've actually banned the ads for an ISP over there that offers a free VPN service to its customers to help them bypass geo-blocks, meaning that the customers of Spin can access things like Netflix and Hulu without having to set up an additional service. Why are they blocking the ads? Because copyright, that's why. Even though using a VPN is actually the most legitimate way of getting content that's not available in your country. Clap, clap, Sky TV. Clap, clap. Rogue Legacy is one of those titles that's actually been around for a while. I'm cheating a bit because it's only just been released for the PlayStation platforms, Vita, PS3 and PS4. Now, I did have this on PC, but I couldn't resist getting my hands on it for the PS4 to help with the gradually expanding library. If you've never played Rogue Legacy before, what it gives you is a randomly generated castle, caves, forest, temple, depending on which direction you go, to fight your way through, battle bad guys, collect coins, and try to defeat all the big bosses. Sounds nice and simple, doesn't it? But Rogue Legacy takes a leaf out of a page of one of my favourite indie games, Spelunky, by being pretty unforgivingly difficult. But, most importantly, it makes it fun. When you first play Rogue Legacy, it's pretty easy to be a bit daunted by it. But this is one of those games where the more you play it, the more you find out, and the more interesting and enjoyable it gets. First up, there's a character selection screen, where you actually get to pick one of the three descendants of the previous character that you used. Now, you start off with some basic classes. You've got your fighter, your magic user, and your knight, all with various abilities, strengths, and weaknesses. It's very interestingly balanced out. I'm sure you can work out the differences just from those basic descriptions, though. What adds to it is each character is given some random traits. Now, these can range from nostalgia, which is one of my favourite, which tinges the entire graphical palette of the game itself in a lovely sepia tone, through to irritable bowel syndrome, which basically means your character goes around and fluffs all over the place, to actually some useful stuff. You've got ones where you have extra strength, or you don't get knocked back by enemies as far. And you can even have things like gigantism or dwarfism, which do change the gameplay quite considerably. If you get a dwarf, you're quite small, you can dodge the enemies and the fireballs and all the things that come at you throughout this game quite easily, but of course you don't have quite the range of the giant, who can swing the sword further, but of course is a bigger target. Where the game really, really takes off is that with the start of each new playthrough, your new character inherits all the money you discovered on your previous playthrough. This lets you spend your money at a castle, which gradually expands depending on what choices you can make. Of course, you've got options to upgrade your attack power, your defense, your magic, but ultimately you can also unlock more character classes and more abilities. You can also create other areas, such as a blacksmith, an enchantress, and an architect. The blacksmith lets you upgrade your gear, but only if you found appropriate blueprints in the castle itself. The enchantress lets you upgrade abilities using runes that you've discovered in your explorations. And the architect, for a share of the gold you earn, can actually stop the castle from being randomized. This adds a surprising amount of depth to the game. Depending on how well you went on your last run-through, your gold could be quite limited, so trying to make the choice of how to spend it can be quite a difficult task. Do you upgrade some stats? Do you unlock a character who can, while being not a good fighter, get more gold, which gives you a bit more to play around with next time you restart the game? And you also need to spend your money wisely, because when you would need to re-enter the castle, you have to pay a toll, or whatever gold you have remaining. Gameplay itself takes you from room to room in an old-time 8-bit style platform game. Yeah, I know the indie scene is pretty much flooded with these type of games, but this one is one of the pearls. The ultimate aim of the game is to find the various boss characters. There's usually one or two hidden in each of the separate areas, and once they're defeated, you can gain access to the big boss. But let's put it this way, I've been playing this game for the better part of 3 weeks, I still haven't defeated any of the bosses. I'm not ashamed to admit it, and you know what, I'm still having fun with it. I've lost count of the number of characters I've been through. Okay, it's just one of those ones, when you die, it doesn't feel like you're being cheated. It feels like you've made a wrong move. Now, like I said before, this game has been around for a while, so I guess now I'll focus on what the new PlayStation version brings you. Well, first up, if you buy it for any of the PlayStation platforms, it's available on all the PlayStation platforms, which is a pretty big bonus. On top of this, there's a cross-save function. So if, say, you're playing it at home on the PS4, and you've got a Vita, well, you can actually have your save transfer over to your PS Vita, and play it out and about. And then all the progress you make will be ready for you to progress from when you're back home on the big screen. Another thing I found is that on the PC version of this, even though I have a PC that can handle Bioshock Infinite, I found some of the filters and effects used did even slow down gameplay on the PC. Of course, that's not an option on the PS4. It all flows super smoothly and cleanly. Now, given how much you die in this game, it does reward patience. So if you're not a particularly patient gamer, then you may not be too keen on this. Aside from that quibble, I certainly have no hesitation in highly recommending Rogue Legacy on whichever platform you want to play it.
Saturday is the Queen of Pop, Madonna's 56th birthday, and in Brisbane we're holding the biggest party of the year, the 9th annual Brisbane Madonna Party. It has gone on to become one of the biggest events on my calendar each year, and probably one of the most exciting. Now, being the cult movie guy, more than the music guy, I thought it would be quite appropriate to look at that rather dubious subgenre, the Madonna movie. Very hit and miss, especially when you're looking back at her body of work. In recent years, she has since made a conversion to directing, after admitting herself freely that, yeah, she really isn't that great of an actress. I found that she works well in the real breathy, femme fatale type roles, like the namesake Breathless Mahoney in Dick Tracy.
Whose side are you on?
Side I'm always on. Mine.
What about All the Way May in League of Their Own from 1992? She was playing a girl who likes to sleep around. So really, the roles where she plays a floozy and kind of a sexy tart, it works, especially based off her image that she's managed to build up since the early 80s. In some roles, she's managed to nail it, and it worked perfectly to her talents. Others, the films themselves were bad, and Madonna just went along for the ride. Or maybe they're just roles that she just really wasn't that good in. Her film debut was apparently in some 8mm nudie shoot shot in the 70s, which was released by the director at the height of Madonna's career in the 80s. But I will look at the more mainstream ones. Desperately Seeking Susan from 1985 co-starred Madonna with Roseanne Arquette and brought Madonna to the big screen for the world to see and experience. At the time when all the girls in America were copying her look, you know, the bangles, the fingerless gloves, the big hair, and the song Into the Groove was topping the charts. Now, soundtrack tie-ins were always going to be a lucrative and more successful direction for Madonna's film career to take, and that is really where she started to get a lot more of her success. Most of the Who's That Girl soundtrack from 1987 were Madonna compositions, and the title song became a number one hit. She tumbled Marilyn Monroe and Betty Boop together in a cement mixer to create this character in this movie, which works so much for her.
Man, some witch steals my clothes. Miku gets pushed out a hotel window, and now you get fired.
No offense, but bad luck really seems to be following you around.
But again, it's a sexy, ballsy role which seems to be working for her. Much better than playing a missionary in Shanghai Surprise alongside her husband Sean Penn. This has been laughed off the screen, and people have even said the chemistry between her and Penn is almost non-existent. I haven't seen this, and it doesn't sound like I want to. Into the 1990s, Madonna launched her sex period with the band Justify My Love clip in 1990, straight through to the Erotica album, single, video, and the controversial Table sex book. Appropriately, her next roles followed a very similar path. League of Their Own, she played All the Way May when she was always flashing her bosoms and being the ballsiest chick in this 40s baseball team. Whilst being set in the 40s, there's probably not too much she could have done with the role, but she really did run with it. We also had Dick Tracy, which we mentioned earlier around this time from 1990. In the role of Breathless Mahoney, she sings the songs Hanky Panky on the soundtrack, and the character is a lounge singer embroiled with a gang of mobsters in 20s Chicago. She's sultry, sexy, and very much appropriate in the role. Probably her most iconic role, and one that actually got her the most praise, was Evita in 1996. An adaptation of the Andrew Lloyd Webber Tim Rice musical from the 70s, it had taken many years throughout pretty much most of the 80s to bring Evita to the screen, and finally it was decided that Madonna would play the role of Argentina's first lady, Eva Perón. She took vocal lessons. She wore possibly one of the most extensive wardrobes ever seen in a movie, and it actually gave her a Golden Globe Award for Best Actress.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise, don't keep your distance.
So could it be more appropriate that her most popular or most successful movie, and one where she really shines as an actress, is one where she's singing the whole way through, one where she's not out of her comfort zone, let's just say that. The next best thing in 2000 was not the next best thing for her to star in, especially following the success of Evita. She played opposite her friend Rupert Everett, who in the movie plays her gay best friend, and they both end up sleeping together. ...
Robert is the most incredible man. We're never getting married, so we can't get divorced.
The movie gave her a number one hit with the song American Pie, a bit of a fan non-favourite, and possibly one of the worst covers of all time, apparently. Swept Away in 2002 got laughed away by the critics. The plot's been done many times before. Wealthy woman aboard luxury boat with a tired and abused ship hand. The boat sinks. She's left on a deserted island with the ship hand, and the roles end up reversing. It had potential, and I still find it enjoyable to watch, except Madonna does look orange most of the time, and only shines when she does a dance routine mouthing to the song Come Up to My House. There's no Madonna on the soundtrack, so no number one hits. Even the director himself, who was married to Madonna at the time, said in an interview, this is a terrible, terrible movie. So, looking back at what we've discussed, it looks like the movies where she's actually featured appropriately on the soundtrack, performing songs within the movie, they're more likely to be hits. And really, if you're a singer form, first and foremost, it should really be what you stick with. Vogue, 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 Vogue.
Why would you risk your life for this?
Because right now, life's giving us a chance.
To do what?
Something good, something bad, a bit of both.
Look, I'm not going to beat around the bush. Guardians of the Galaxy is the best Marvel movie so far. It exceeds the Avengers, and considering that it comes from a much more obscure comic, mind you, I think plenty of people would have thought Thor was pretty obscure too when it first came out, really does show how much work has been done in bringing this movie to such a wide audience. In Guardians of the Galaxy, we see Peter Quill, played wonderfully by Chris Pratt.
Why would you want to save the galaxy? 'Cause I'm one of the idiots who lives in it!
Who was abducted from Earth as a young boy. We don't see him again until much later, when he is, shall we say, introducing us to his in-movie character quite spectacularly in a glorious opening scene. He gets his hands on a mysterious orb, and what follows is quite the adventure, as many people are trying to either get their hands on the orb or on Peter Quill himself, for various reasons. It doesn't take long to meet the other Guardians, Gamora, played by Zoe Saldana, Drax, by Dave Bautista,
I will fight beside you.
Rocket Raccoon, voiced by Bradley Cooper, and Groot, voiced by Vin Diesel. These guys come together in yet another glorious, hilarious scene set in a crowded city, so definitely lots of fun with that one. You know what? That's where I'm going to stop with the plot synopsis, okay? This one pretty much needs to be as spoiler-free as possible. In the lead-up to this, watching the trailers, I was a bit worried that they were actually showing a bit too much, but rest assured that the trailers barely scratched the surface. This is one deep, entertaining, and surprisingly varied movie. You've got the main bad guy, Ronan the Accuser, played by Lee Pace, who is suitably sinister and relentless.
I will destroy you and your world.
Michael Rooker, who you may remember as Merle from the Walking Dead TV series, plays Yondu, Peter Quill's, well, I guess you can call him compatriot, who has quite a history with Peter, shall we say. I suppose the main movie stars of note are John C. Reilly and Glenn Close. They both play fairly major parts with relation to NovaCorp, who are almost like the police in this particular little movie, but you certainly can't call them main characters. Amongst the Guardians themselves, look, all of these guys play the roles wonderfully. Vin Diesel doesn't really get to do too much voice-wise, being that Groot doesn't really say a lot.
I am Groot.
But Groot is wonderfully animated and definitely a very fun character. The real standouts in this already excellent group are probably Dave Bautista as Drax and Bradley Cooper as Rocket.
That's a fake laugh.
It's real!
These two characters play off each other and provide some of the greatest lines in the movie. There was one point where Rocket was being very sarcastic about a particularly serious moment. I was almost falling off my chair. This is a movie that will keep you laughing. The Doctor Who fans out there are probably pretty curious about Karen Gillan's appearance as Nebula. If you don't know that name offhand, she played Amy Pond. She doesn't really do a great deal in this movie, but she does do it well. The character is a bad guy and gives off a very nice sense of menace. And when the inevitable showdown between her and Gamora occurs, it is spectacular. And she certainly shows she has got the chops for a bit of action when required. I strongly suspect we'll probably see a lot more of her in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which has already been confirmed. Look, I could go on about the actors for quite some time yet. It's a big cast, and there is a lot of strong performances, both from the main players and the support cast. As you'd probably suspect, the movie looks gorgeous, full of colour and life and movement. Okay, I guess that's pretty par for the course. One area where the visuals in this movie truly stands out is just the absolute stunning vistas of space. You see so many movies where space is just kind of the background. It's there, it's dark, fair enough. This movie gave the sensation of the vastness of space so well. I can't remember the last time I saw something where you actually got this feeling of being in this vast, empty void. It was stunning. Incidentally, I'm not a big fan of 3D, but see this in 3D, okay? I'll just say it now. See this in 3D. You will not regret it. Another great standout of this movie is the soundtrack, which largely comes thanks to Peter Quill's prized possession, a Walkman and a mixtape. So much of the action hooks back to the music that Peter Quill is choosing to play at the time. It's a nice device, and it works wonderfully well. Plus, you've got to admire a massive, epic space opera adventure comedy that can throw in a Footloose reference and be in context. Now, if you are a fan of the comic book, and believe me, you don't need to know the original comic to be able to enjoy this movie, but for fans of the comic book, there are quite a few little references, appearances, and just background detail that you will definitely appreciate. So between the fantastic performances, the gorgeous visuals, the amazing soundtrack, and the epic story, look, there's already a massive list of reasons to see this movie. But let me just throw in one more for those who have been following all the Marvel movies. Guardians of the Galaxy is the movie that finally reveals what's connecting them all together. I mean, true, you can look on the internet and find out yourself quite easily, but it's nice to see it in the movie itself. There is so much more I want to tell you about this movie, but I promised myself that I would keep this review as vague as possible. Simply put, Guardians of the Galaxy is a must-see, even if you're not into the Marvel movies. It is a masterpiece. And yes, I nerdgasmed. Okay, I'll admit it, I'm not ashamed. Complete, utter nerdgasm.
We're the frickin' Guardians of the Galaxy.
I'm with them.
Boy? Oh boy.
You would have been able to guess when we started doing the redeeming features section, when we started looking at these movies, both obscure and infamously bad, there was going to be one movie we were going to get to at some point. One of the poster child of the bad movie. Really, for probably a decade plus after this movie came out, it was generally heralded as one of the worst movies in the world. But is that really true? And does that still stack up when compared to some of the other gems we've looked at in this segment? So for this podcast, Christian and I are having a look at Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Oh, Christian, what can you tell us about Attack of the Killer Tomatoes?
Oh, okay, well...
yes, well, I put it on you.
Yes, damn it. Oh, released in 1978, it really did, as you said, became the poster child for B-grade movies. And I really think that, you know, in my line of work with doing cult movie screenings, I even have people that I say, I do cult movie nights. And the first thing a lot of people do say is, oh, do you screen stuff like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes? Even as a title... A lot of people probably even never seen it, but it's got such a reputation for being this movie, you know, so iconic for being a B-grade. But it's probably, when you think about it, it's probably the Rocky Horror of B-grade movies. Rocky Horror encompassed every possible, I suppose, genre of the time of Hollywood. And I wonder, too, if Attack of the Killer Tomatoes is really, you know, supposed to be the ultimate B-grade movie. It is so tongue-in-cheek, so sure of itself. But yes, as you said, Trevor, it does top many worst movie lists. But usually movies that are topping worst movie lists are ones that are bad without knowing they're being bad. This has tongued very firmly in cheek and many times poked right out at us. So I think, I definitely think it's one of the better films to be featured in Redeeming Features.
Yeah. Oh, and to give a bit of, a basis, the movie starts with a spiel about Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds being probably one of the more famous of, I suppose, bizarre horror movies. And then if you look back, another one that I can think of that I think may have been part of the inspiration for Attack of the Killer Tomatoes was The Night of the Lepus, which was actually about a horde of killer rabbits. And I can just picture these guys sitting around one night looking at all these ridiculous horror movie concepts, probably slightly intoxicated or, shall we say, influenced by particular substances, and going, what's going to be next, tomatoes? Followed by a significant thoughtful pause.
Hence creating, you know, one of the ultimate vegetable or fruit, depending on how you look at it, movies. I believe, now Trevor, you may have a IMDb page handy. I was wondering, I do believe that the tagline for the film was something about a musical or something like that. They do make reference to being a B-grade musical, and in many ways there's probably only three songs, two of which are terrible and one which is semi-catchy, but probably one of the most excruciating parts of the movie, and Trevor, you'll know this, is when they go and visit the man in, I believe it's New York, who ends up singing that terrible song about turning tomatoes into to warfare, pretty much. I believe that was what it was. And that, to me, is one of the most excruciating parts of the movie.
The songs are pretty excruciating.
Yeah, but that said, I would rather listen to the theme song. I'd rather have that song in my head than the other kind of Donny Osmond puppy love type song called Puberty Love. It was actually sung by a very young Matt Cameron, who went on to be the drummer for Soundgarden. I think that was a better career move for him. Puberty Love is used, I don't want to give away too much, but it is played throughout the soundtrack of the movie, and it is supposed to be, you know, at the time that the film is set, it's supposed to be the hit single at the time, and it's a really high pitch. It makes Donny Osmond look like he's singing bass. And it's really quite excruciating. I won't give away because it's a really big, it is a lot to do with the plot, this song, but it is horrible. But whereas the theme song, with lines like, you know, I know I'm going to miss her, a tomato ate my sister, you know, with a song like, with lines like that, you're thinking, yeah, this is a great way to start the movie, especially after coming out of that bird's scroll and then going to the credits and then going to a scene in which a girl is attacked from a tomato that she's actually cutting in the sink. It decides to take its revenge on her, and therefore establishing all the, I suppose, the horror and thriller movie cliches that will play out for the rest of the film.
Yep. I mean, that theme song really is probably one of the highlights. I got to admit, I love that theme song. And if you listen carefully, you may just hear a little snippet of it toward the end of this segment.
Ooh.
Yes.
And the theme song is it is the ultimate way of opening a B-grade movie too. So maybe it's like science fiction from Rocky Horror. It's the equivalent. I don't know. Yeah. But I think definitely the tone of the movie is set in this, by the way, that not giving too much more away. There's a lot of scroll across the text. Very tongue in cheek, as I mentioned, this movie is. So you'll see a lot of times for furniture ads and sales this week, you know, 1 week only. And very much relevant for when they came out in 1978, not so relevant in 2014, but it is interesting to see this is the kind of things that these people were doing, throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, into this movie. And it continues throughout the entire thing. Like I said before, there'll be a switch of scene to New York or San Francisco, but it's got a really big question mark at the end, and then you'll see that it's New York, but there, you know, it's obviously there's the Golden Gate Bridge. So
deliberately mislabeled. Stock footage of places. Oh no, yeah. It's an old gag, but you know what? It's still not a bad gag.
Yeah, it works. I know we are supposed to be thinking of Redeeming Features. They, you know, they do exist, and I think but I definitely don't think they lie in our lead characters or our lead actors. I believe the actress's name was Sharon Taylor, or that might have been the character. No, it was Sharon Taylor, I believe, and the guy I called John Belushi, who plays Mason Dixon. Did you think he reminded you a lot of him? Did you get that?
He did a bit. He was that. I suppose that style of actor, David Miller, is our Mason Dixon
from the movie. Oh, yes, yes.
And, I was going to say. And he has that Belushi look, but none of that Belushi charm.
I think he's the poor man's John Belushi. But and then Sharon Taylor, probably one of the, no offense to her, she looks like she could have just been the friend of the director or the cameraman, but she's probably one of the least likely leading ladies you'll ever see in a movie. And I don't know if you noticed, Trevor, at one spot where they wouldn't have had time for retakes. She's waiting for she's waiting, spying on this guy, and he walks past her, and her glasses fall off her head, and she catches them, and they drop it. They obviously didn't decide to retake it. They just kept going.
I think they made a lot of this up as they went along.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't it doesn't live up to its title, and it's what all these little, like what we're saying, it starts off so well, but it doesn't kind of maintain it well. But to me, probably looking at what kind of keeps it going, and probably I'm dipping in already now to the redeeming features list, but it's the fact that it made so many great references to other movies. You know, there were scenes with, all the army men running past with all their guns and, shooting, explosions and tomatoes pretty much. You know, there's a scene, went very Jaws-esque, let's just say, replacing the tomatoes with...
That was definitely on my list. Swimming, bikini-clad teens, and they're doing underwater shots with just all these tomatoes bobbing in the water, apparently attacking them. That was pretty magical. I'll give that a big tick.
I don't know if it's me looking too much into it, but I did also note it was the year that Jaws 2 came out, and Jaws 2 actually has a scene very similar to a lot of those, and even, I suppose, the first Jaws movie, where they're lying on rafts like that, are definitely the second one as children, like in Killer Tomatoes. So I'm thinking, that's interesting. They were very aware of what was happening at the time. And but not just things like that. There's even probably my favourite scene in the entire movie is when the guy's sitting, I believe, in a library or a classroom, and there's just silence, and he goes, "Tomato," and the entire room just evacuates. That's probably the best part of the entire movie. But no, folks, there are other moments.
Those tomatoes, they were so sinister, especially with that voice they gave the tomatoes. That little...
Oh, yeah.
God, I'm looking at it now.
And it's like they do contrast a lot to the voice of the carrots, but that's another story.
Yeah, it's like a spoiler. There is I suppose it does set up a teaser at the end involving a different vegetable product.
Interesting, they didn't decide to go that. They instead decided to make some sequels to Killer Tomatoes and put people like George Clooney in them. So, but this one is all, I think, as a result, actually, of I think it's Return of the Killer Tomatoes, which has George Clooney. That often gets, I suppose, seen more favourably than this first movie. And often when I screen it, people go, "Oh, it's George Clooney's first one," and then realising it's not. So it's good to see that this has got that reputation, even though a lot of people haven't seen it, or it has become, the go-to movie if you're going to reference what the hell is a B-grade movie, what the hell is a cult movie, let's go for that one. So, but it's definitely, its tongue's firmly planted in cheek. So,
but then again, I guess I do have trouble calling this a cult movie in a way, in that it was deliberately set up to be what it is. You find like cult movies are often things that just aren't taken in the way they're intended. They have like this sleeper thing behind them, and they gradually build a following until people just kind of rediscover it in their own ways. Whereas Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, it's obvious from the outset that it knows what it wants to do. It has so much references to things that would have been big at the time. I mean, you've got the horrible B-grade movies with ridiculous premises. There's quite a bit of gags at politicians and stuff at a time when there was a lot of stuff in the press about the waste of the American government. And you've got this thing where the president is using a pile of papers, the presidential signing paper, and just signing one piece of paper with one pen and then you're throwing the pair of them away.
Yeah, all you see is the hand, yeah.
And, I mean, it was just poking at so many things. It was even, you compare it to stuff like even, say, Kentucky Fried Movie, where you just, instead of having a series of separate gags and sketches, it just rolled it into one not quite cohesive movie.
And it was so, yeah, and it just threw so much in. So it really does transcend, yeah. It is hard. I could probably get into a whole discussion about what defines a cult movie, but probably my angle with lumping it into, you know, like mentioning it like I did before in that respect is probably the fact a lot of times cult film can be generated just from reputation alone. And I think the reputation of this definitely far exceeds the movie. A lot of cases they do. But yeah, it is a hard one to doubt. But I think putting it on the pedestal as one of the ultimate B-grade movies possibly could work. But the fact that they went out, as you said, and attempted to make this movie like this, it'd be a bit different if this was them trying their absolute hardest and this is what happened.
Yeah, trying to make a serious movie about Killer Tomatoes, that was never going to happen.
I've actually got the DVD box sitting right next to me of the film, and it says one of the best movie... I love how this is the only quote they could find to redeem it. One of the five best movie titles of all time. And that also sums that up, really, that it can't... In many ways, it can never live up to that title it has got. It's such a campy title. I love movies like Attack of the Giant Leeches and Attack of the Crab Monsters, and they've just, you know, taken them straight out of the 50s and brought them to 1978. And I just think that in that respect, like a lot of these 50s movies, they don't live up to it. Attack of the Crab Monsters, you wait around for an hour and 5 minutes just to see a crab with a few strings on it for the last 5 minutes. So I think it's just hard for them to have lived up to it. But it's very much a B-grade movie, consciously.
Especially when you have things like there's a car chase at one point, which is probably one of the most ridiculous car chases ever caught on film. Not only for the fact that there's a guy with a parachute stuck in the door of one of the cars who's kind of being dragged along behind. But you look at it, they're in a town, then suddenly they're in the countryside, in the open road, then driving across grass, then back into town, and the scenery just keeps changing between almost every single shot.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that simple bad movie, bad editing, and you can tell it's been done deliberately.
Oh, definitely. It's so aware. And as you said, it's like they have sat down, you know, with all these movies, and they've almost literally done a textbook version of how to make a bad movie, really.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that is definitely what I've got from this.
And I think that is leading us into then the redeeming features. I think the redeeming feature is it has achieved what it set out to do. Whilst it might not be as... okay, overly entertaining, it's still a good way to spend 80 minutes. You know, you still have a bit of a chuckle, and there's some interesting things. And definitely if you're a movie buff, and hey, most people are aware, even if they're not a movie buff, they're aware of these genres and could enjoy it. So I think that's probably the angle. You know, don't go in with expectations, but, you know, expectations of being fantastic, but I think anything called Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, you're going to have that kind of thought anyway, you'd think.
Yeah, I mean, that probably is my approach as well. But yeah, I mean, this is a sort of movie, it's almost, you can imagine it being put on for film students almost, saying, look, these guys set out to make this movie, they set out to make fun of these particular tropes, and even though the movie itself is deliberately horrible, they do achieve it. It's a good exercise. I think it's a good movie education film about movies. Not necessarily the best thing to do with movies, but it does hit a lot of its marks.
That's really an interesting, you know, way of looking at it. Like, it's the, you know, it's the go-to, the guide for how to make a bad movie, you know, and make money out of it. Because I'm sure, you know, it was financially successful. And considering it wasn't independent in production, and I do see that, you know, there's all the sequels, and I think it ended up becoming a TV cartoon series as well.
I remember the cartoon series.
Pardon? You remember that?
I actually remember the cartoon series.
What the plot of it was, I would have no idea. I might have to do a bit of research, but I'm wondering if it is surprise, surprise, attack. I mean, tomatoes attacking places. That would probably be it. But I do know the third movie was, I believe, called it Killer Tomatoes Attack Paris or France or something like that, and then it was the TV series. So I assume they just kept on doing their bad work.
Yeah. The other thing to look out for in this movie is the most unlikely love story in existence. The main leads barely look at each other, but at the end have this terrible, terrible love duet. I still don't know what to make of it or what to think of it. You start with the very, very strong, fantastic theme song, and each song that comes through, you just think it can't get worse, and each song that comes through, it does get worse. It's a magnificent achievement.
Exactly. But then before we scare off people that we are trying to, you know, get to re-experience this movie, it is calling itself a musical, but there'd probably be about three or four songs in it. It doesn't become too much. But, yeah, as Trevor's saying, the ones that do happen, you need almost 20 minutes to get over it anyway before the next one hits.
Aside from the theme, there's musical numbers.
So don't be scared off by that, because I honestly don't think an entire musical of this concept would really work anyway, unless they started bringing in the tomatoes singing, but that would just get awkward.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yes, I definitely think it has a lot more to offer than, you know, possibly some other titles we've looked at in the past. And if it's your kind of thing, if you like a, dare I say it, I get in trouble for using this term, but if you're a fan of So Bad It's Good, you know, this is definitely a movie you should check out or re-experience. It might have been a while since you saw it. I know it used to play quite a lot when it came out at the old Village Twin up in New Farm. Apparently was the cinema for to see it in Brisbane quite a lot. So, you know, I try and bring it back to the big screen whenever I can to make people live through it, experience it.
This is textbook So Bad It's Good. This is the movie that wrote the guide to So Bad It's Good.
Yeah, one of those movies that if you left going, oh my God, that was so bad, it's almost like, did you need to say that statement?
Yes. Yeah, you go in there knowing that.
Exactly. But just going back, going back to the final scene, it's so awkward, you know, this love duet between them. And not to give too much away, but they make it even more awkward by swapping the vocals, that's all I'll say. As if that scene wasn't already awkward enough. Yeah. They have to have him singing in her voice and her singing in his voice, so.
And both voices are just ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. Leading into possibly the opening of what they were planning could have been a sequel with involving the other vegetable, as we mentioned, but maybe that's in the pipeline. Mm. I have actually heard reference in the last couple of years of thoughts of remaking the film, but, yeah, I don't think it would really be the best type of thing. It's definitely up its time.
Yeah, a remake would either have to just try to recreate it pretty much as it was, or actually go a whole gritty reboot angle, which I don't think I want to see that attempted.
Could you imagine making it so serious that they actually fall for the fact that this is happening? I just don't think.
Yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, if they did that, how could they have the pass the ketchup line?
Oh, I know. As said by a guy dressed as a tomato, but yeah, yes. We'll leave it to the folks to see it. Now, this is actually it's actually not the easiest film to find, but you can find the DVD occasionally or get it imported from overseas, or there may be other means of finding it. So it is definitely a bit of a rarity nowadays. I was fortunate to get the 25th anniversary DVD, but I believe it has never been released on DVD into Australia. So. So that's probably a lot to do with why it's got a reputation. A lot of people actually haven't seen it.
If you get a chance to see it, definitely see it. And if you definitely. do see it, let us know what you thought.
And hopefully we've managed to encourage you to watch it in some way, or if it's not your kind of thing, managed to turn you against it. Either way, we'll be happy. We've impacted on someone's life.
Either way, whatever works, let us know.
Definitely.
Okay, well, a little bit later on, we're actually going to be announcing our first Redeeming Features-themed competition. So definitely keep listening for that, and the movie that it involves, well, you might just hear a little bit more about it next time. Well, Christian, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Trevor. It's been great speaking vegetable movies, or fruit movies, depending on how you look at it.
I'm sure someone will get very upset with us calling tomato vegetables. So
I'll just assume it's got like a slash between it, and yeah, it's one word. So yeah. We'll keep everyone happy.
Attack of the killer tomatoes! Attack of the killer tomatoes! They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch.
As we head towards the end of August, it's time to look at some last-minute events that are happening around Brisbane. On Saturday the 16th of August is the 9th annual Brisbane Madonna Party, celebrating all things the Queen of Pop, with her music from the 80s, 90s and now. This is taking place at the Port Office Hotel in Edward Street, Brisbane CBD, from 6 to 11 p.m., all Madonna, all night, all awesome, $10 to get in. If Tim Burton's more your thing, on Wednesday the 20th of August, we're screening the classic Johnny Depp movie, Edward Scissorhands, at New Globe Theatre in Fortitude Valley at 6:30pm. Tickets are available for $10 at the door. For those of you who have been listening to our redeeming features section, you might also be interested in Tragic Tuesdays, a new concept we're launching monthly at New Globe Theatre. This is taking place on Tuesday the 26th of August, the first screening, with a movie called Zardoz from 1975, which stars a nappy-clad Sean Connery. Tickets are available for $10 at the door and include popcorn for this one. You won't want to miss these each month. Heading into September, just a bit of a taste, we've got The Fifth Element on Wednesday the 3rd of September, The Original Evil Dead on Friday the 5th of September, the 40th anniversary screening of the cult classic Phantom of the Paradise, and then Brad Pitt favourite Fight Club, which screens on Wednesday the 17th of September, and we might tie it a little bit into Meatloaf's birthday in some way. For more details about upcoming events, visit www.christianfletcher.com or find me on Facebook. I look forward to seeing you at an upcoming event.
I'm really excited about the competition this week because, as we mentioned earlier, it's our first redeeming features-themed competition. This may or may not be a good thing, but, well, we're certainly willing to give it a try, and we hope you are too. So what's the prize, I hear you ask? Well, we have a double pass to see the infamous debut of Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie business, with Hercules in New York, screening at Room 60 on September 3rd. This is a movie which is very much worthy of its upcoming redeeming feature section in this very podcast, but here's your chance to see it before hearing about it. And if you're willing, we want to talk to you about it if you win this prize and go along to see the movie. So, how can you win this great prize? Simple. Just leave the comment Pretzi, P-R-E-T-Z-I, in any of the usual places. Look, all the links are down below, or we'll go through them at the end of the podcast. Good luck. Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Don't forget you can head over to our YouTube channel to check out trailers and videos relating to the stuff that we've talked about in this very episode. And look, if you have any comments, suggestions, feedback, whatever, requests, you can also contact us by finding The Rufus Project on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, head to our Podomatic page, or even leave us a review on iTunes. Be very much appreciated. We're also on the lookout for anyone we can talk to. So if you or anyone you know should be featured in our local wildlife section, then let us know by dropping us an email at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Now, if you remember from last time, I asked if anyone had suggestions for sign-outs. So, what better time than now to get that underway? So until next time, anyone who puts a slice of pizza on bread is a pukache pukache. That's Aztec for lazy farmer. I looked it up on Wikipedia. Thanks for the suggestion, Susie, and see you all next time. Seriously, I want to see a tradition with Guardians of the Galaxy, where at the very end of the movie, people spontaneously start singing a particular theme song from another movie that's related. This ties into the end credit scene and the podcast I mentioned earlier. So again, don't go into that any further until you have listened to that podcast after watching the movie. Okay? I'm going to stress it again. I can't stress it enough. See this movie. Full stop. See Guardians of the Galaxy. See this end credit scene. Listen to the Who You Gonna Call episode, and you'll know the song I'm talking about. Come on, let's make this a thing. It would be awesome. Oh, I'm so excited. I want to go see the movie again.